You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday. Whew, we made it. Time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panel, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Heath Drusen, a freelance reporter and former Guns in America reporter at Boise State Public Radio. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Gemma.
Hello.
All right, so we really need to begin with the domestic extremist terrorists breaching the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday and for a brief time stopping democracy from happening as Congress was in session to certify Joe Biden as the next president of the United States. So, Jimmy, can you take us back to even before the session and what our four congressional delegates who you've been watching closely, what their plans were when it came to objecting to what are frankly totally unfounded claims that the election results were not valid.
Sure. So you had Congressman Russ Fulcher, who is one of two congressmen here in Idaho, say for a while now that he was planning to object to the certification of the Electoral College votes from a couple different states, and he ultimately did decide to do so even after this insurrection that happened at the Capitol on Wednesday. The other three members of the congressional delegation, which are Senator Jim Risch, Senator Mike Crapo, and Congressman Mike Simpson, they did not support those objections. But you know, you did have Congressman Fulcher going on different talk radio shows across the state, saying that, you know, he basically pushing these baseless conspiracy theories that the election had been stolen from President Trump and that these states did not conduct the elections in the way in which their laws were written. Both he, Congressman Simpson, and Governor Brad Little signed on to a lawsuit from the Texas Attorney General trying to invalidate millions of votes in different battleground states across the country. And that effort failed by the Supreme Court, as have more than 50 other cases that the Trump team has brought in different states across the country related to voter fraud.
So, I mean, Heath, as Jimmy so eloquently said, I mean, you're talking 50 court cases, right? The Supreme Court rejecting these conspiracy theories that the election was unfounded. However, you have been covering these extremists for quite a while now through your reporting with Guns in America. And you have been very, very vocal about the fact that this something like this was going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who is surprised hasn't been paying attention. Yeah. And frankly, most people haven't been paying attention, including the federal government. You know, basically all we had to do was listen. Everybody.
Right,
you know,
absolutely.
Everybody who. Right. I mean, you know, the people who descended on the Capitol said exactly what their plans were. And then the president got up and talked to them and basically said, go to the Capitol. And then they did exactly that. So the fact that anyone's claiming to have been caught flat-footed is sort of astonishing. I mean, this was all being talked about on open source social media. You know, I know not a lot of people are on Parler and Gab, but there's no reason that if you're somebody in charge of a response to something like that, you can't check that. It's not locked. And yeah, you know, Jimmy mentioned this, you know, Jimmy mentioned that there were all these efforts to overturn the election. And I think that's really important. You know, he mentioned that the efforts failed, which they did, but these things that people like Brad Little and Mike Simpson and pretty much every high-ranking Idaho Republican, it seems like, except Lawrence Wasden, signed on to, they fueled a lot of this conspiracy theories, efforts like that, you know, fueled these conspiracy theories. And these were the grievances that the people who stormed the Capitol were bringing with them. So there's a lot to answer for right now, because mm-hmm. these efforts and what happened at the Capitol, you can't talk about one without the other.
And
Gemma, to Heath's point about how nobody should have been surprised, if people are surprised to see the protest has given way to insurrection. They need look only at what happened at the Idaho State House in August during the 3-day special session when you had, you know, when you had folks breaking windows and in doorways and storming the gallery. The difference, there were chilling similarities between what we saw on Capitol Hill on Wednesday and what we saw at the Idaho State House the last week of August. One difference was that the Idaho insurrection, nobody lost their lives, thank goodness. But again, this should surprise nobody. This has been this is the pattern. This is the trajectory.
And Heath, you brought up something I think was interesting about these social media sites like Parler and Gab, and that how the federal government was left flat-footed with this. However, you talk to any reporter who has followed right-wing extremists for the last 4 years during President Trump's one term. Even weeks, in the last couple of weeks, they were talking, I mean, up to 2 days before January 6th, about their plans to go to D.C., about their plans to storm the Capitol. I mean, reporters were seeing this. And I would assume that federal departments have more information, federal intelligence departments have more information than reporters.
Yeah, you would hope so. And they do. Of course they do. But, you know, we've had more than a decade of federal law enforcement really dropping the ball on monitoring violent domestic extremism. They've understandably been very focused on foreign terrorism. I mean, obviously that is something that we've dealt with in the U.S. and it's certainly a very important priority. But a lot of the experts I speak to, including people who used to work in the federal government on these issues, say that it wasn't a priority. And, you know, people who spoke up about this growing danger, a lot of them were shut down and in some cases even chased out of government. So this has been building for a long time, both the movement's strength and the sort of blind spot that the federal government had. And I don't think it was helped by an administration that frankly didn't really seem too interested in dealing with the violent potential of some of these movements.
So Jimmy, I want to go back to after these extremists were cleared from the Capitol building, and we should say very peacefully, unlike the BLM protest that took place over the summer. I think that's incredibly important that we make that difference. But Congress went back into session. I mean, they were adamant that democracy would continue. And what if anything then changed with certain lawmakers in particular? Talk to us about Congressman Russ Fulcher and his decisions.
Well, seemingly nothing changed with Congressman Fulcher's decision. I mean, he objected to at least two of the, or supported at least two of the objections for certification of these electoral ballots. None of the other three, the three members of our congressional delegation did, nor had they given any indication that they would have beforehand. You did see some other lawmakers who had said that they would support those objections change their minds. I mean, you had Spokane Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers, who's a pretty high-ranking House Republican, said that she changed her mind and did not support those, as well as, outgoing Georgia Senator Kelly Loeffler. So, but Congressman Fulcher was not one of them. Other than that, after people had been cleared from the Capitol, you saw, plenty of senators and representatives stand up and give impassioned speeches about how they were going to continue to do the work of the people, and that, you know, they weren't scared and going to put it off and certify Joe Biden as the next elected president of the United States. But you did see, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of House Republicans still object, and plenty of other senators do so as well.
So Heath, since the president has not taken accountability for his actions in this insurrection, this sedition, frankly, it looks unlikely that Vice President Mike Pence will invoke the 25th Amendment. And yes, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and other members of Congress are talking about then trying to impeach him. He would be the only U.S. president then impeached twice. But are there concerns about another uprising in the next 12 days?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would almost be surprised if we didn't see something. I don't know what we'll see, but there are a lot of people talking about January 20th, Inauguration Day, and taking action and trying to stop Joe Biden from taking office. I mean, this is not over. And the fact is that, you know, I'm not weighing in on what, you know, what the cabinet should or shouldn't do, what Congress should or shouldn't do. That's not my job to weigh in on that. But I will say all of this talk about removal, whether or not it's the right thing to do, is certainly going to only inflame people more. The reason people were storming the Capitol is because they think falsely that the election was stolen. And that is certainly not going to go away between now and January 20th. So I would hope that authorities in the Capitol are not going to be caught flat-footed again, because you know, it was kind of ridiculous the first time, and now I think it would be unconscionable. But yeah, there's a lot of talk about taking action, and you know, I think we're going to see something. I don't know what. And I have to imagine that folks at capitals like the Idaho Capitol are probably bracing for something as well. I mean, you know, as was mentioned before, we saw it back in August, and fortunately, it wasn't as disastrous as the U.S. Capitol siege. But who knows? I mean, I think there's a lot of wild cards right now.
And before we take a quick break, Keith, I'm actually curious about what you've been seeing. The reaction in other parts of the world about what happened on Wednesday here. You're actually living outside of the country right now. So would love some perspective on that front.
You know, the international reaction I've seen has been sort of just people in disbelief, kind of scared about, you know, what is happening in the U.S. And in a lot of ways, kind of starting to write us off as a reliable superpower. And I mean, it's kind of hard to blame them. And there is a bit of Schadenfreude as well. You know, countries basically saying there was a headline that's become famous now in Kenya, who's the banana republic now. So it's this mix of sort of like laughter and fear and looking to who else might be the sort of stable superpower to look to, because right now, frankly, we're not a great example for the world.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. More with our reporter roundtable right now. Our panel today, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Heath Druzin, freelance reporter and former Guns in America reporter at Boise State Public Radio. And I do want to get into the upcoming legislative session, but before we do that, Don, some really big news coming out of one Boise-based fraud prevention company. I mean, literally, this just came down minutes ago.
Yeah, we just posted this up on BoiseDev.com. Count, which is based at 10th and Main here in Boise, was founded more than a decade ago, has been agreed to be acquired by Equifax, or Equifax, which many people know as the one of the companies that provides your credit reports and does credit monitoring. But they have a number of other businesses as well, and they have agreed to pick up the Count business for more than $600 million.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And this is the second one in like 6 months. We had the folks over at Cradlepoint selling out to Ericsson for more than $1 billion. So these kind of mid-sized Boise businesses are getting snapped up. Importantly, for people who maybe don't work at Count, and of course those who do, the folks at Equifax have said that they are going to keep the Count headquarters here in Boise and keep the offices, and that employees will become part of their, one of their divisions in the company. So pretty big economic story for Boise. And you know, when you get these news releases, you always wonder if they're going to keep offices here. And just like T-Sheets and just like Cradle Point, they do say that they will stay based here.
And so, Don, if, just to clarify, so it sounds like Count will actually, will they keep their name as well?
Doesn't say that in the news release. So we don't actually know that. All that they would say is that they will, the employees will become part of the Equifax United States Information Solutions Group. We saw this with T-Sheets, which essentially didn't keep its name. They became part of Intuit. The Intuit signs went up on the building. But that was good for employees, the employee base out there, because Intuit hired people to work on products beyond just the T-Sheets thing. And they've actually grown the employee base here and started work on a second headquarters building.
Well, and Count did a massive renovation of that building on 10th and Main where
they did. They took a fairly empty 100-plus-year-old building and did basically a gut job on it, added an additional story to it and a rooftop deck and a new retail on the ground floor and really revitalized that. And that was, I was going to say last year, but it was 2019.
It feels like so last year.
Yeah, the last year Count. No pun intended. That was not intended, literally. So a pretty big deal for employees out there. You know, I've been hearing some chatter that something might happen, and here we are.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that moves forward, though. Yeah, some big news, though, for that business. So we need to talk about the legislative session because it begins Monday, Idaho's 2021 legislative session. And Kevin, you wrote a legislative preview recently, and in that you say it's a bit unsettling to convene a session in the middle of a global pandemic and then throw in potential protests. And we talked about this a bit in the last segment because we saw some significant protests at the State House during the special session in August. And I think there was a very good point made. I think Heath made it in the last segment about what happens on January 20th on Inauguration Day, and Idaho's session will be fully going.
Yes, it will. That will be the heart of the second week of the session. We open on Monday, and, you know, as I wrote this story, I wanted to talk to folks who also spent a lot of time at the State House to kind of check my own perceptions as a reporter who's been there for a number of years. And what I heard from education leaders, from stakeholders who are there on a daily basis, that they're going to approach the session differently. They're going to watch a lot of the session remotely. They're going to be there when they have to testify on a piece of legislation, but not be there day to day, partly because of the pandemic, partly because of the questions about whether there's going to be proper social distancing. And I know there are going to be some safeguards in place. I know there are going to be some modifications, but are those modifications enough? And as I was doing those interviews on Wednesday morning, I also talked to folks about the protests that we saw, the insurrection, the siege that we saw at the State House in August. And they said, two of the folks I spoke to independently said, this is a real concern. There are folks who are really shaken up and terrified even by what they saw unfold at the State House in August. And those interviews were before the rioting and the insurrection that we saw on Capitol Hill. So I think it's going to be a very different legislative session for everybody who participates in it, not just the legislators, the lobbyists who are paid to be there, the staffers who are paid to be there, the engaged, concerned citizens who want to have a say in the process. It's not just affecting reporters. It's affecting this whole ecosystem of folks who operate and participate in the process there. I don't know how it's going to look. And I don't know how, I said in my piece that, maybe the most, concrete goal for this legislative session is for everybody to get to adjournment with their good health. And I don't mean that to be flip. And I don't mean that to be hyperbolic. That's the reality of convening a legislative session in the year 2021.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, will the public be able to testify remotely?
That kind of remains to be seen, and it really will vary from committee to committee. Now, the state did put some money into upgrading their technology. So I think you will see, I think you will see more opportunities for remote testimony than you have in past sessions, but it really is going to vary.
And then, Jimmy, you recently sat down with the folks over at Idaho State Police because, I mean, when we saw what happened in August at the State House, when we saw what happened Wednesday at the U.S. Capitol, I am assuming that they are looking at potentially ramping up security for the legislative session.
They were looking at that beforehand. And yeah, I spoke with Colonel Wells this morning, actually, on Friday as we're recording this. And he said that, you know, the Coronavirus Financial Advisory Committee had approved 8 additional state troopers who will permanently be at the Capitol for the session to help, you know, enforce social distancing requirements, et cetera, that they tried to enforce at the special session and pretty much failed to do so, with crowds ripping down signs that were meant to block off certain seats and people pushing past uniformed officers to get into the House gallery on the first day. And so they will be present at the Capitol. That's $350,000 estimated cost that they got to cover that. But then Boise Police will also be kind of on backup to help with any kind of additional needs that might arise. And I did ask Colonel Wells directly, you know, have you heard about any threats for this upcoming legislative session, especially in light of what we saw Wednesday? And he said no, unequivocally, no, we have not seen anything like that, and we will be prepared to handle whatever might come our way.
So Kevin, I'm curious too. I know that there's been a lot of back and forth between lawmakers about wearing masks and not wearing masks. What will that potentially look like? I mean, that was a huge issue in August, with some lawmakers frankly not wanting to be there, but having to be there.
Well, I think not just what we saw in August, but what we saw in December when legislators got together for their organizational mm-hmm. session to elect leadership, sort out committee assignments. You had a number of legislators who were not wearing masks. They were not observing social distancing. I think that, you know, that behavior, on top of what we saw in August, on top of what we saw in late March at the very end of the regular legislative session, just as, you know, Idaho was reporting its first coronavirus cases, you know, I would not assume that legislators are going to be wearing masks. It's been kind of left to the legislator's individual discretion.
So then what potentially happens if legislators get coronavirus and can't legislate? I mean, could that potentially put the session at a standstill?
This is such an uncertain time. I mean, we've never seen anything quite like this, except that, you know, we saw during the December organizational session that we had 104 legislators who were present for that organizational session. One legislator was not there. That was Scott Syme, a Republican from Caldwell. Well, the reason he was absent was that he was home recovering from COVID-19. So I don't know what this is going to look like in terms of what happens if a legislator contracts coronavirus, if that spreads from one legislator to other folks at the State House. We just don't know.
I just want to jump in real quick just to, you know, remind people of the mm-hmm. stakes. This is not theoretical. The Speaker of the House in New Hampshire died of COVID after they had a maskless get together with legislators. So, you know, it's we're talking about, you know, legislation and, you know, theoretical votes, but it's also, I mean, it's a deadly disease. And I think a lot of people mm-hmm. in Idaho maybe kind of forget about that.
Had a legislator in Wyoming die a couple of months ago also from COVID-19. I mean, it has happened in other states to Heath's point.
Yeah, and we should say, too, that there is no policy in place, when I spoke with Speaker Bedke last month, to regulate any kind of anything, really, over the conduct of lawmakers, whether it's, you know, any kind of mask mandate. But certainly, they're not being required to get tested before they come here. They're not required to be vaccinated when those doses are available to them. They are not in the priority line just because they're legislators. But also, there's no policy in place for lawmakers who, if they do get the virus, for them to be required to be out of the building even, or notify other lawmakers if they get it. And Speaker Bedke just told me that he's relying on the good graces and manners and, you know, expectations of polite society to kind of win out the day on that one.
So starting
in that
Monday.
But in that same vein, though, you have legislators who, as a matter of public record, have said that they don't think that this virus is that big a deal. You have, you know, straight up COVID doubters, skeptics, and deniers within the legislature. So
you have the
good graces
governor,
of
Kevin,
legislators is going to vary from individual to individual.
You have the lieutenant governor who says that. I mean, so basically, come Monday, the State House could be a daily super spreader event. I mean, truly, and I'm not being flip in all. I mean, there is that potential with that many people in an enclosed space with no mandates in place. We're going to take a quick break. Go ahead, Kevin.
No. I think you're going to see some changes, you know, in terms of what we see on Monday. You know, Governor Brad Little is going to deliver his State of the State address remotely, as opposed to having the address on the House floor in front of 105 legislators, in front of state elected officials, in front of, you know, you used to have about 200 people, I guess, on the floor of the House. Mm-hmm. That's a super spreader event. It won't be quite the same on Monday, but that's just one event. We'll take it day by day and see how it unfolds.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. With our reporter roundtable today, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Heath Drusen, a freelance reporter and former Guns in America reporter at Boise State Public Radio. So, Kevin, pandemic aside, though, this really could be an incredibly significant session, legislative session, from a policy standpoint.
It really could be. You know, I think the centerpiece of the session is going to be the coronavirus and the response to the coronavirus, the governor's response, and legislative pushback over that. We heard that in the special session in August. We had legislators not just question the severity of the coronavirus and the pandemic, but also question the governor's steps to respond to the coronavirus, the outlay of $1.25 billion of federal stimulus, the move to an online only, to a vote-by-mail election, I should say. There's going to be a lot of pushback between the legislature and the governor over separation of powers and, you know, what we saw in the response to the coronavirus in March. And, you know, we're 16 months away from the Republican primary. Don't think for a minute that the political season isn't already underway. And if it is, and if it hasn't, you know, bubbled to the surface, it will this legislative session. Mm-hmm. And I think the power struggle between the legislative branch and the executive branch is going to be the centerpiece. I mean, you mentioned the lieutenant governor, who may or may not be a gubernatorial candidate anytime soon, but Governor Little will get challenged from the right in the 2022 primary. We can make book on that. We just don't know who it might be. And we do know, and we could pretty well surmise that the coronavirus and the response to the pandemic will be a centerpiece issue. So it'll be a centerpiece issue in this legislative session. Plus, you got a $600 million surplus. We've never seen a $600 million surplus in my recollection. That's a lot of money to fight over. It's going to be a wild session from the policy end.
Right. You're totally right. And then, Jimmy, on top of all of this, two Idaho Democrat lawmakers are suing Speaker of the House Scott Bedke.
On top of everything, yes, you put it perfectly. So you had yesterday, Thursday, two Democrats, Representatives Sue Chu and Muffy Davis, filed that lawsuit in federal court against Scott Bedke, saying that he's violating the Americans with Disabilities Act by not offering them reasonable accommodations to vote remotely and give them an enclosed office space at the Capitol so that they can do their work in a safe environment. You have Representative Chu has hypertension and diabetes, and Representative Davis has a spinal cord injury and paraplegia and uses a wheelchair. She also has a 12-year-old daughter who's asthmatic, and all of these conditions puts them and their family, well, at least the daughter, at risk, higher risk of having significant complications if they do contract the coronavirus. And, you know, I spoke with Representative Davis yesterday, who said, you know, this was the last thing she wanted to do. They've apparently been having negotiations behind the scenes for a while now, trying to find some kind of accommodations. Speaking of that special session when people broke into the House gallery, part of that area was supposed to be reserved for Representative Chu, according to the lawsuit, so that she could be, you know, distanced from other folks who, like Kevin said, you know, don't wear masks on the House floor. Lawmakers not wearing masks on the House floor. And they set up a microphone so that she could debate and cast a vote up there. But once those people pushed their way past, you know, uniformed officers, they occupied that area. And so she theoretically could have gone up there, but felt even less safe up there if she were to take on that accommodation.
And have we heard from Speaker Behnke at all, Jimmy?
Yeah, we got a statement from him yesterday saying that he's disappointed that these negotiations had gone this way and that the Republican leadership team was trying to make the session a safe environment for everyone. That's all I've heard. However, there were court documents filed this morning saying he intended to respond, you know, with his own filing and motion to dismiss sometime later today.
So are we expecting to see both of the representatives at the State House Monday?
It's unclear. Representative Chu, I tried to get a hold of her. She had a family emergency that she had to take care of yesterday afternoon. And Representative Davis said she wasn't sure either. We should say that every Idaho lawmaker does have the ability to appoint a substitute lawmaker who can debate and cast votes in their place. She, when I asked her, she said that she wasn't sure if that was something that she, would do at this point. But she hopes to be there on Monday, as of right now.
And, Kevin, we've touched on this, about concerns, that lawmakers have. I mean, of course, this lawsuit is a prime example of that, of the concern about COVID at the State House as we go into this session. I mean, and the numbers are far worse now than they were in August. I mean, in fact, where are we when it comes to COVID right now?
Well, you're right. The numbers are worse than they were in August. I think we're north of 140,000 cases statewide confirmed and probable cases. The death toll is now sadly above 1,500. You know, and some of the largest increases are in Ada County, not just raw numbers. I mean, we are the largest county in the state, so the raw numbers would be higher. But in terms of new cases per 100,000 residents, Ada County has been running one of the highest rates in the state. That's where the legislature is going to be convening starting in 4 days. We are, relatively speaking, a coronavirus hotspot. So, yes, it's a concern for, you know, everybody who has a stake in, you know, participating in the legislature, mm-hmm. whether you're paid to be there or you're there out of passion for public policy.
And we should note, Don, you were on the show earlier talking about the vaccine rollout. And Kevin, I know you've been following that as well. And I believe there's a meeting going on as we are live on the air,
yes,
in regards to this. But can you guys talk a little bit about that? Because, I mean, again, slow rollout of the vaccine. I mean, it seems Idaho is doing a bit better than other states, but still not where we want to be. Anyone want to talk about that?
I was waiting for Don there, but just really quickly. I mean, we're seeing the rollout occurring gradually, and the numbers are starting to ramp up a little bit. I think we're up to about 28,000 cases. Doses have been administered as of this morning. The hope being that some of these, you know, critical workers, such as school teachers and K-12 staff, might start to see mm-hmm. you know, might get access to the vaccines starting in February. So, but as you say, the committee is meeting as we speak. So, you know, it's a developing story.
Yeah.
So I was having a mic issue. So I was speaking to myself that whole time, which was awesome. The one point I did want to make is the state is working on getting, and I didn't hear Kevin's answer because I had to reconnect, so I apologize, but the state's working on getting more granular information on what's happening with the vaccines. And as of Monday, they would just tell us how many doses were administered. Now we actually know how many individual people have received the vaccine, yes, because of course these vaccines require multiple doses. So we're at 26,000 people who have the vaccine. So we're a little bit over that 1% mark, which is good. And I mean, I think every day that number grows, and I think we all want to see it grow as fast as possible. Gosh, you know, if we can really start to vaccinate the general population by May, it's going to be a big win.
And we should note that new information came out today in regards to the Pfizer vaccine, at least, that it looks to be effective against this new strain of COVID, which is much more, you can get it a lot easier. So Heath, I'm going to put you on the spot real quick. I'm not sure if you've actually paid much attention to this, so it's okay if you don't have an answer. But being out of the country, I'm curious to know what it's like when it comes to COVID over there with, I mean, mask wearing, vaccines. Are you seeing a difference than what's going on here in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, and I mean, I guess I'll say Idaho because, you know, Idaho is also different than a lot of other parts of the U.S. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to addressing COVID, we're much worse than a lot of other places. Although, you know, there's certainly a spike going on all over the place. But yeah, there's much more mask wearing. There's a lot more rules. And, you know, there's places where there's actually fines for not wearing masks. So yeah, basically a lot of things that I just don't think we're going to see in Idaho. And also just a lot lower rates of infection. You know, there's there's countries with 10 million people that have fewer cases per day than Idaho. So yeah, there's a very different protocol. There's a very different attitude towards it. And probably not coincidentally, there's fewer deaths and fewer cases.
Yeah. We're also taking a quick break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. More with our reporter roundtable. Our panel today, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Heath Drusen, freelance reporter and former Guns in America reporter at Boise State Public Radio. So, Dawn, in the middle of a pandemic, protests at our state house over the summer, people are still finding Idaho a very desirable place to live. So we're apparently either number one when it comes to people moving here or number 30.
Yeah, as my eternal frustration with these news releases that say things that are based upon bad data continues, United Moving Company put out a news release saying that Idaho was the top destination for inbound moves for the year. And I was like, well, that's weird because I saw U-Haul said we were 30th and started to look at their data. Yeah, right? And it's like, well, they're both moving companies. How can it be so different? A little different. So there's a bunch of factors at play, and I tried to break this down. Even if you look at United's data, Idaho is not number one. We're actually number two behind Vermont, but they set kind of an arbitrary floor and was like, well, they didn't have enough moves, so they don't count. So I was like, well, that's kind of weird. And then when you look at U-Haul's data, they have a much bigger base. They do 2 million truck rentals a year across the country, whereas United only had a couple hundred thousand full-service moves, right? So these are different audience segments, first of all. And then you started to kind of pick into it a little bit, and it wasn't clear that any of the data really made sense. And that was sort of the point of the story that I wrote was, this isn't maybe the most reliable source. And so I saw some headlines that were like, oh, Idaho's number one. Oh my gosh. It's like, well, who knows? We're actually trying to get maybe some data that shows it in a way that isn't quite as prone to data challenges. And so that's a story that Boise Dev's Margaret Carmel is actually working on right now, because it is really interesting. You know, the rankings I don't think really matter, but mm-hmm. we do know that Idaho is a significant destination and that that accelerated during the pandemic. We just don't know maybe where we compare with other states.
Yeah, and that would be an interesting thing. So, Jimmy, let's go back to the upcoming session for a minute, because I'd like you to talk about the property tax proposal that Idaho Democrats could be pushing.
Yeah, on top of everything else that's going on at the State House. So these property taxes are high of mind for a whole lot of lawmakers coming into this session. Not a lot got done last year, aside from one bill that made it so anyone at any time when they bought a house could apply for a homeowner's exemption, as opposed to having to wait a whole year in some cases before they could do that. But, you know, Democrats want to raise the amount that people can receive through that homeowner's exemption. They want.
Did we just lose Jimmy? Okay. Well, we're going to try to get him back up and going. But Kevin, I want to go to you for a minute while we get Jimmy reconnected. One thing that we haven't talked about for quite a while is Idaho's go-on rate. And I'm wondering if so much, I mean, of course, you know, 2020, the pandemic, I mean, we were just trying to get kids through the school year, right? And that's what we're trying to do this year. Well, but where are we with our go-on rate and trying to get kids to go past high school?
Well, it dropped, and it dropped precipitously. So the latest numbers for the class of 2020, high school graduates from the spring of 2020, only 38% of them did something this fall to continue their education, whether that's two-year college or four-year college or career technical. That's 7 percentage points lower than we saw right out of the chute for the class of 2019. So that's 7%, 7 percentage point decrease. That translates to about 1,400 students who didn't continue their education or didn't, you know, go on in one manner or another. And the big question is, are these students just taking a gap year? Are they just kind of waiting out the pandemic? They're concerned about the health risks of going to a college campus. They're concerned about paying for online college education as opposed to the face-to-face experience. So the question is, will these students show up after they take a gap year, after the pandemic wanes? I mean, that's the big question that nobody can really answer at this point. But what we know is that the longer students delay their college experience, mm-hmm. the less likely they are to continue. They may get a job that they want to stick with. They may get married. They may have a child. All of those life experiences, life changes, make it more difficult to make the leap to go to college. So, not really surprising numbers. We knew that those numbers would probably decrease, but that's a significant drop.
That's really significant. You know, Don, I think it's fair to say that this has been an incredibly tough year for so many businesses. 2020 was. In particular, the restaurant scene, we have seen a record number of restaurants shutter in 2020. And in fact, we've got two more closing, but in the middle of this, there are actually restaurants opening up.
Yeah, I mean, so we've reported on a whole slew of these, some closing temporarily, like the Sunray Cafe in the North End, some closing their doors permanently, like Beer 30 in Bound Crossing, which will close next week. But we have a new eatery opening in a portion of the old Chicago space downtown called the Union Block Pub and Eatery. That's going to be from the folks who brought you Mai Tai. And there's others. I've actually got one that I did a tour of this week, and I'm not going to say the name because the restaurant news business is very competitive, but it's going to open up, and it's a higher end type of thing. And so it's interesting that we are seeing this dynamic of a lot of folks calling it quits for good, calling it quits for the winter, or opening up something new. And restaurants change a lot. I mean, this is the case during the pandemic and not, but it does seem like we've had quite a few more that have said, hey, you know what? We don't have the revenue. We can't make it anymore. Even the stimulus options aren't going to do it, so we're going to close. Once we get into summer, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. And when I talk to restaurateurs privately, ones that are open, they say it's really hard and we're doing everything we can just to hold on, because we know if we close, it's going to be impossible to open up again.
Yeah. We've got Jimmy back. Jimmy, I've got about a minute. Can you quickly wrap up about the tax proposals?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry about that. So top line takeaways, basically raising the homeowner's exemption, tying it to local housing markets in each specific county, raising the circuit breaker, which is available for low income, seniors, veterans, people with disabilities, to just waive those taxes entirely, up to $2,000. That hasn't been touched for a long, long time. As well as get rid of a particular exemption for very large businesses that make huge infrastructure investments in Idaho. Whereas Republicans want
Micron.
Micron, aka Micron. Republicans want more budget transparency and potentially reining in how much they can county and cities can spend at any given time.
All right. I've got 20 seconds left. Thank you, all of you, so much. Kevin Richard, Don Day, James Dawson, and Heath Drusen. Always appreciate your insight, guys. Happy Friday. Have a good weekend.
You too, Gemma. Thanks.
Hey, Gemma.
Joey, get your iPad.
Joey, get your iPad.
Peace out.
Happy Friday, everybody. Peace out. We'll see you here on Monday. I'm Gemma Gaudette.